Hello, and welcome to Literally from the North Shore. This week we are sharing some short stories by Duluth author Connie Ellis. She was the author of The Ice Dancer, the novel recently shared on Literally from the North Shore. Today we're going to hear Connie's story, Judy Garland's Mother's House. In this story, we spend an afternoon of wonder on a Duluth rooftop overlooking Lake Superior. The story was recently published in Lost Lake Folk Opera, a literary journal based in Rushford, Minnesota, and is used with permission. So let's listen now to Connie reading Judy Garland's Mother's House.
Judy Garland's Mother's House. I ran into Nancy Lee in the North Shore Theater in Duluth, Minnesota. It had been some years since we had seen each other, and I was embarrassed that I couldn't recall her name. It seemed inexcusable, like forgetting one's sister's name. After all, we had been roommates for a summer during our college years, and I certainly hadn't forgotten her. She used to sit out on the balcony on warm summer evenings with her guitar and sing Joan Baez songs, her voice as clear and true as a nightingale's. She crooned, she crowed, she howled like a Ginsberg angel back in those days of our youth. She always seemed to be in another dimension out there on the balcony, completely alone and at the same time part of the night, part of nature, like some odd fallen star that had landed on a campus apartment balcony in Minneapolis, Minnesota, quite by chance, and had decided to stay and sing a song or two. The old renovated theater seemed an appropriate place to run into her again, with its expansive Art Deco interior, high ceilings with chandeliers, plush turquoise carpet with bright zigzags and twirls, and a wide circular staircase, dramatic enough for a Betty Davis entrance. A tall, attractive man accompanied Nancy Lee. He had a notable head of wavy blonde hair and stood in the shadows like a man who just moments before had stepped down from an old movie poster and was not quite ready for real life. Nancy Lee and I exchanged telephone numbers at the top of the staircase, then went our separate ways as a fresh batch of popcorn popped in the lobby. 1 week later, Nancy Lee and I are standing beside a house that looks like it could tip over. The support from one corner has been removed, leaving a fourth of the house perched above a pit of fresh dirt. This is the house where Judy Garland's mother lived when she worked as a seamstress. She lived on the second floor. Nancy Lee has always known things like this, unusual things hardly anyone else knows about, so I'm not surprised to be standing by the lilacs next to this pile of dirt outside of Judy Garland's mother's house. Nancy Lee starts right up the old metal fire escape stairs. I follow. On the second story landing, I am wary. Close up, this house looks really old. A metal ledge circles the back of the house and is wide enough to walk upon, but is it strong enough to hold us up, to hold us both up? She marches right out onto the platform. I venture out one step, barely putting my weight down. A ballerina step, or a coward step. Nancy Lee is heavier than I am, and I hear no buckling of the metal, so I follow cautiously while she talks about Judy Garland's mother. Her name was Ethel. I know, very old-fashioned, but probably a very cool name in 1912. Anyway, Ethel played the piano for silent movies and got a job at the Savoy Theater over in Superior. Judy was the youngest, born in Grand Rapids. This house was moved from its original location down by the courthouse, she adds, but doesn't know when. I saw an advertisement in last week's Budgeteer News for the Judy Garland Festival up in Grand Rapids, but I think this is more fun, partly because it's more dangerous, and partly because it's like our own small festival. Besides, it's free. We stop at the windows and peer inside. The rooms are empty, and most noticeable are the wooden floors. Beautiful wooden floors with soft afternoon rectangles of light from the windows, a wooden floor with any number of possibilities. Here you could dance, do yoga, meditate in the middle of a beautiful oriental rug of many colors. We are both silent, contemplating the floor, Judy Garland's mother's floor, Ethel's floor. She might have kept her sewing machine over by those tall windows so she could enjoy the squirrels in the trees while she worked. It would have been one of those heavy oak and steel machines decorated with gold arabesques with little drawers for buttons and bobbins and a foot pedal for propulsion. She might have had a piano against that long inner wall by the bedroom. The silence of the empty apartment makes the wind of in the trees seem loud. And I think of contemporary silence as when the electricity goes off and one is startled by a sudden emptiness, as when Thomas Hampson's voice from a CD stops mid-phrase and you listen carefully to the quiet music, the hum of a refrigerator, the drone of a TV. I imagine Ethel working in her quiet apartment, the only sound the rhythmic pedaling of the sewing machine treadle. Perhaps she hears the iceman's horse pass by, its hoofs clicking dependably down an unpaved road. Or she might be at an old upright piano, slightly out of tune. Brother, can you spare a dime? Did Judy Garland's mother laugh in this very room? Dance? What did it smell like in the kitchen? Did she bake raisin cookies? Did she sit in that little kitchen and eat oatmeal and sip coffee on chilly Duluth mornings? Did she smoke? Could there be a cowardly lion in the broom closet? Nancy Lee is as quiet as I am. She looks lost in thought, too. Maybe she is picturing Liza Minnelli, all glittered up and ready to go on stage in cabaret, rehearsing here in a dream, shaying around on the wooden floor of the empty room, fluttering her eyelashes and sighing theatrically. Or perhaps she is thinking of her own mother, who was a professional dancer, dancing on floors like this. The empty apartment, with its wooden floors, is so full of promise and mystery that we lean toward the windows expectantly, as if for a play about to begin or continue. You can see Lake Superior from out here on the ledge, though you probably couldn't see the lake from inside, or perhaps just a bit from the kitchen. My mother wasn't allowed to take dancing lessons because my grandmother considered dancing not quite proper and in the same category as black net stockings, decadent. But my mother's best friend, Jean Grandseth, took lessons, and after class taught my mother the steps in Grandseth's green garage on Skyline Parkway. My mother can tap, Charleston, waltz, anything. She has a natural talent. She could even walk on her hands. Both she and Jean Grandseth could do that. We leave the window and Nancy Lee sits down on the roof edge facing the lake. I unfold a scarf to sit on. We each have an orange to peel. We stare out at the lake like old men sitting in rocking chairs on their porch, peeling oranges and rocking, deep in thought and absent-mindedly content. A ship is nearing the harbor, but is still quite far off. Out above the lake in the watery blue sky, I picture my mother walking on her hands, a Chagall-like figure walking along a cloud, occasionally flipping upright to do the Charleston. Maybe Nancy Lee sees her mother dancing out there too, all dressed up, sophisticated and glamorous, instead of how she really is now, in a nursing home. On a roof, you can see things, put things in perspective. These oranges have nice thick peels, and I eat some of the white. The orange oil is pleasant in the air, and I can smell the lilacs in the yard below. Next door, the deep red peonies are just beginning to open. A penny for your thoughts, I say, surprised that I'm using such a dumb cliché. God! Nancy Lee says, and laughs her complicated laugh of many syllables, a laugh like a poem, or at least a haiku. A boat whistle blows, long and low. We watch the aerial bridge rise slowly. Have you seen the dancers who dance on the bridge? I ask, and tell her my visits are usually just before or after that performance. She's seen them, she tells me, and it's like they're flying above the bridge, above the water, like bright, mythical birds, and the seagulls come too, and swoop up and down so the dancers and the birds are all choreographed together, and it's quite wonderful with the music and the squawking. I want the music to be Mozart's magic flute, and I think of it over the water and here on the roof. Now, what to do with the orange peels? My friends the Keatses had shrimp with Mrs. Dylan Thomas once, sat by an open window, throwing their shrimp peelings out the window. Ever since, I've wanted to do that, but I would feel like a litter bug tossing down the orange peels here in Duluth. You're having a dilemma, Nancy Lee says, watching me puzzle over the orange peels. Use your purse. I do as she says. The boat passes under the bridge and into the harbor, an oar boat. During the war, my dad saw a man fall into a giant vat of molten steel, I tell her, the most violent image I know. That's sick. Telling me that is just sick. I know, I confess. It's because of the peels, not knowing what to do with them. Not knowing. She looks at me for a while, Buddha-like, and I can feel my aura being analyzed. I think you should meet Andreas, she tells me after some time. Andreas has been so reclusive, though. For the past 10 years, he's been terribly, terribly reclusive. She shakes her head slowly. Just like me, I think, but make no comment. Did you ever ride on the bridge when it was going up, I ask? You can't do that, she says. You can't do that. She looks so stern. I tell her I did it as a kid. I was so skinny I could lie down flat, and no one even saw me go up, that I heard the cable squeak after the warning bells rang, and I went straight up with the bridge, and stayed up, too, turning onto my stomach to look down through the steel mesh to the water below, and I watched the ship from South America come right through, the big white ship that carried coffee, floating over the blue water below, the most beautiful ship in the world, and I saw it all from the bridge, when I was only 10. And then the bell rang again, and the bridge came down. That was back when the bridge was black, before they painted it silver white, I noted, as if that made it riskier, more dangerous. It was black, she says. Well, I sigh. After a long pause, I ask if she knows the bridge over by Leif Erikson Park that's made of dark granite. She does. I tell her how we used to stand on the bridge after Sunday school. We would stand in its curved center and wait for the train. It felt like you were standing on top of a thick castle wall because you couldn't see the opening below for the train to pass through. Instead, it looked like the train would crash into the wall you were standing on. When the loud, smoky black train got close, I would scream and run off the bridge. My brother David stayed on the bridge the whole time. I admired that. I always admired my brother. I'm sure I'd run, too. I'd scream and run, Nancy Lee says, laughing. Usually I'm not a runner, though. I let things come. You're a rock, I tell her. Granite. Coal. Lodestone. I could be a rock, probably, I say. Sandstone, perhaps. Or on my best days, amber. Well, that's not exactly a rock. Lapis lazuli, Lake Superior blue, cold, Nancy Lee says, and pretends to shiver. I like the way she pronounces lapis lazuli, carefully, dramatically. Lazuli, lapis lazuli, I repeat. I'm feeling happy now. The sun has come out, and we're in a cheerful, sunny spot on this roof. She didn't sing too well, Judy Garland's mother, Ethel. It was her father who had the voice. They met in Superior. Nancy Lee lies back on the roof, setting an orange peel on each eye. Remember that time you called me up and then sang every number from Carmen on the phone, I ask? No. Well, yes, she laughs, rearranging the peels. I needed a preview. I was a very good Carmen. You should have seen me. She kicks out a plump leg. I like being on the roof. It's fun being up high like this. Anyway, why did they do Carmen? I mean, Carmen is so un-Minnesotan. She doesn't appear to be listening, but I don't mind. She's humming her Carmen rule. Suddenly, she gets up and rushes across the rooftop ledge, calling to me that she'll be right back. Maybe she will, maybe she won't. She might forget or be distracted. As she leaves, I watch two sailboats out on the lake. It's Wednesday, sailboat day. Must be too rough, or there would be more. I settle back to enjoy the boats and note the white caps off Park Point, my mind relaxed and bobbing pleasantly like the waves. The fire stairs shake as Nancy Lee rushes back up the stairs and stomps over the roof ledge. I call Andreas, she says. He's waiting for a truck. His marble is coming in on a Mayflower truck. Oh, that's right, he's an artist. I had forgotten. Somehow I thought he was one of your poets. She sees I notice the bottle of wine sticking out of her jumper pocket. Madeira. I bought it yesterday. I don't drink anymore, so I bought Madeira. She may be apologizing with her eyebrows or expressing excitement. I can't tell. But it seems classy, sipping Madeira on the roof of Judy Garland's mother's house. We should have wine glasses, though. I decide to go look for some in the empty apartment, if I can get in. Nancy Lee settles down on the roof, and I am off on my wine glass mission. The back door is locked, and there are storm windows in all the windows, except for a kitchen window, which I can't get up. It's either locked or stuck. I use the file on my nail clippers as a lever, and the window slides up. This is fun, I decide as I climb through the window. I brush aside the dead flies on the window ledge and ease myself down to the floor. Inside, it smells like wood shavings and lemon, at least at first, until I sniff something that makes me think of old magazines and sprouted potatoes. Stepping on the actual floor gives me a genuine thrill. The sun on the floor really does emphasize the emptiness of the apartment, and I automatically raise my hand to my heart and take a deep breath. I bend down, prepared to study the scuff marks on the floor of Judy Garland's mother's house. These marks on the floor have meaning. I stare, as I sometimes do, at Vincent van Gogh paintings, noting the brush strokes, thinking that Vincent stood in front of this very canvas, made that very mark. Now these marks, these footmarks on the floor. I shuffle around the kitchen as if I have some affliction or am waiting until my feet start dancing of their own accord. Then I get to business and open the cupboards, one after the other, all empty except for old newspapers, lining the shelves. Luckily, though, the pantry is filled with canning jars. I remove the lids from two, put one in my purse, and hold the other in my hand as I climb back down, politely shutting the window behind me. Almost gleeful with the wine glasses, even if they're only canning jars, I settle down on the roof, ready to celebrate. Nancy Lee pours the Madeira into the pale green glass jars. I had forgotten how sweet it is, sweet like brandy, and there's something grandmotherly about it. We sit on the roof of the empty house and sip wine like we're the most aristocratic of the aristocrats. You would think Nancy Lee was Queen Elizabeth. She's so dignified. Tell me about your poets, I say. Well, there aren't that many, she says, just a few. A few poets is enough. One would be enough, actually. I had one once, I tell her, one poet. Yes, he slipped away. Ah, yes, they do that, one way or another. They slip away. Look, there's the truck, the Mayflower. That might be Andreas's marble. We watch the big truck go east along Superior Street, excited as kids watching the ice cream truck, and we totally forget our recent exaggerated dignity. Tell me about his sculpture, I say. Egg shapes and bone shapes. Very sensual, she tells me. I pour us each another glass. Look, more sailboats going out. So tiny. Sail away to Jesus. Nancy Lee belts out like a southern gospel heavyweight. Sail away. Finishing my Madeira, I wonder how many birds she just woke up, and I feel dizzy as I look out over the lake, surprised that the sun is beginning to set. My legs feel long and stretched out, dangling over the roof ledge, and I retrieve the orange peels from my purse and toss one over the ledge. It's pleasant, watching an orange peel flutter down through the air. Van Gogh, I say as I toss the second peel. Kandinsky, Nancy Lee says, helping herself to several of my peels. Van Gogh's brother, I say, tossing the largest peel. Kandinsky's grandmother, and the rest of them, Andreas too, Nancy Lee says as she tosses the last of the peels with a flourish. We laugh, and the middle of the roof kind of shakes. Nancy Lee slaps it with her hand, and it makes an echoing sort of reverberation. The house is laughing, she says. Are we drunk? She asks seriously. No, we're just a bit off, I tell her. We decide to climb down while we can, and carefully. On the fire stairs, we decide to do this again someday. Someday soon, next Wednesday, Nancy Lee suggests. But I leave for Denver tomorrow, I say. Ah, well, life always ends with unfinished business, she says matter-of-factly. We go our separate ways, each settling a green glass canning jar into the beverage holder of our respective cars. As we drive away from the house, we toot our horns, like two seasoned tugboats ready to chug right along into the future, come rain or come shine. The end.
Go to sleep, you weary hobo. Let the towns drift slowly by. Can't you hear the steel rail humming? That's a hobo's lullaby. Do not think about tomorrow. Tomorrow come and go. Tonight you're in a nice warm boxcar. Safe from all the wind and I know the police cause you trouble. They cause trouble everywhere. But when you die and go to heaven, you won't find no policeman there. I know your clothes are torn and ragged. Lift your head and smile at trouble. You'll find happiness someday. Go to sleep, you weary hobo. Let the towns seasons drift slowly by. Don't you feel the steel rail coming? That's a hobo's lullaby.
May God's blessing keep you always. May your wishes all come true. May you always do for others and let others do for you. May you build a ladder to the stars and climb on every rung. May you stay. May you grow up to be true. May you always know the truth and see the light surrounding you. May you always be courageous, stand upright and be strong, and may you stay. Changes shift. May your heart always be joyful. May your song always be sung, and may you stay.
You've been listening to Connie Ellis's reading of her story, Judy Garland's Mother's House. It was followed by Arlo Guthrie's Hobo's Lullaby and Joan Baez's Forever Young. Tune in again tomorrow for Literally from the North Shore.